On March 16, 2000, two sheriff's deputies were shot in Atlanta. Jameel Al-Amin, a Muslim leader and former Black Power activist, was convicted. But the evidence was shaky, and the whole truth didn't come out during the trial. My name is Mosi Secret, and when I started investigating this case in my hometown, I uncovered a dark truth about America. From Tenderfoot TV, Campside Media, and iHeart Podcasts, Radical is available now. Listen to the new podcast, Radical, for free on the iHeart Radio app or wherever you get your podcasts.
Welcome to Torre Show. Today's guest, Jodi Patterson, the author of a powerful memoir about womanhood and life with a trans son. The Bold World is a beautifully written book about how her son has guided her to a new life. I've known Jodi for a long time, and I couldn't wait to talk to her about this awesome book.
So I'm in a shared Uber in San Francisco. And there's one guy and three women. And we're listening to the Kavanaugh hearings. And the man says, gosh, this is a really tough time for men. It's really difficult for men. And so I just let that sit there for a minute. And he didn't really go on. And he just kind of kept sighing. You know, I said, however you look at it, I think those times that we might be talking about before are over. And mm-hmm. the time now is different. Mm-hmm. And it just made me think about all the men that I know. Just what does this time look like for you? I thought that was such an irrational statement. It's so hard for men because as a woman, I feel a certain way. But what do you think about that?
Well, a lot of men feel like that, feel a certain fear, feel certain confusion, feel like, you know, the ground is sort of shifting underneath our feet. And I think the first thing we have to prioritize is that things have been very difficult for women forever. Mm-hmm. And women are just asking for justice. Mm-hmm. They're not even asking for like reparations, Black people, but just like, hey, can we have like an even playing field? Can we have like a safe, like work environment? Can we like, you know, walk down the street without like getting attacked? And like, you know, women in general are not asking for anything that they have not deserved the entire time. I just think that men have had to shift our understanding of what's acceptable rapidly. And
I'd say the same thing for women. I mean, I think that we are shifting our, because when we think about it, we all had a skewed understanding. So what might have been okay in my mind then is not okay today. And I think that shows the shift in women's perspectives too. And that's probably the hardest to take, because it's like we made these contracts with our friends and our coworkers and our wives 5 years ago, 10 years ago. They don't stand today because the perspectives have changed.
About when I was first in the workforce as a very young person, and I remember this one office I worked in where it was normal for in the afternoon for the younger men to give back rubs to women who were their buddies. And like, this was almost every day that you'd be like rubbing somebody's shoulder. And at the time, that was fine. I mean, and it was always with consent that it was, you know, this was your friend who was okay with. But, you know, now that would be unthinkable, you know, and I think about, you know, just sort of, I mean, this again, the suggestion, the request is, can you please be a gentleman? Mm-hmm. And if that is too much for a man, including me, then like, you know, you need to reconsider everything. You know, the request that women are making is not too much, is not some, you know, grand thing, you know, it is for basic respect and like, you know, allow me to just do my job as a human being and go home. Yeah. And that is absolutely.
I agree. The baseline, we're asking for baseline. And I, you know, that what we are asking for is not extraordinary. It is baseline respect. And I think it also goes, you know, when you look at it like a pyramid, have you ever seen that pyramid around rape culture? Mm. So the bottom is like, catcalling, elbow grabbing, and then you get a little bit higher, and then there's sort of like body shaming, slut shaming, and then you get a little bit higher, and then there might be something that like a physical threat, and then when you get to the peak of rape culture, you have physical, abusive, violent rape. But all of that sort of escalates into the top of the peak, and all of it's connected. So rape culture is this idea that, well, it's the opposite of gentleman. It's the opposite of respect, but it is take, touch, in all ways of the body, but also of the land. I mean, I don't want to get too esoteric, but like, you know, I think the culture of rape is about taking what you want. And you see that with women's bodies, but you also see that with the way we treat just nature and the land. So I think it's like a real shift, paradigm shift, in terms of how we approach each other and also how we approach life in general.
Well, I mean, you know, relate something that I see in your book, because one thing that I saw in myself, because just had to do a lot of thinking about what it means to be a man, mm-hmm. and how I could see there were different ways that I was sort of consciously thinking about trying to be, you know, an ally and trying to be a good guy. But then deep down, you have these feelings that make you respond in certain ways in certain situations. And, you know, before all this, I had no emotional intelligence whatsoever. I had no sort of awareness of my emotions. So it was impossible for me to sort of become aware of somebody else's emotions, because mm-hmm. I was blind to my own. And when I started to probe, I saw that what I had learned from my father and the men of his generation is that the man is supposed to be in charge in any given moment. And I saw different moments when the kids would sort of seem to disrespect me, or my wife was not sort of backing me up when I was telling the kids to do something, and I feel disrespected. And as a man, I'm not in control, and I'm not the guy my father was. And you talk about that a lot mm-hmm. in this book, that the mom also feels like she should be in control, right? And she should be just on it, on top of the situation. And when your then daughter says to you, "I'm a boy," you are like, I have no control of the situation. Mm-hmm. I have nothing intellectually for you. Emotionally, I don't know what to do. I am not in control of the situation at all. And you learn over time to surrender, right? And that surrendering of the feeling that you should be in control is so liberating.
And difficult, right? Yeah. And difficult. Yeah, yeah. I mean, most of the time as adults, by the time we're 30, 40, almost 50, we have seen it all, we think, right? So we think, and done it all, taken the subway route, dealt with difficult coworkers, unruly children, you know, bad behavior from the folks around us. We know what to expect, and we kind of have the answer to things. We know, you know, how to handle a situation. Arduous tasks, but not surprising. And then when you get into a situation, a moment where you have zero, you think you have zero information, it does not match up to anything else. And so when my child Penelope said, "I'm a boy," it didn't match up to anything. I didn't think I was equipped to respond, to offer a path forward or a solution to fix. And so, you know, you don't give up as a parent. You still try to fix. You try to figure out what you could do to address the situation and make it better. So make this child be proud of being a girl. Make this child into a happy, smart, healthy girl. That's what I assumed, right? I assumed this Penelope was a girl. Everybody, the doctor said so, looked like a girl to me. But when my kid was saying, "I don't want tomorrow to come. I don't want to be you, Mama. I want to be Papa." I didn't have an answer for that.
Tell me that specific moment of when you finally got to that point with Penelope, because you had been sort of struggling. You knew something was wrong. Every time you tried to touch then her, Right. Is that appropriate in the pronouns to refer to her in the past?
Sometimes in the telling of a story, I might, so that the reader comes along with me on the journey. But really, the child that I have today is the same child I birthed.
Okay.
I've changed my pronouns. So I no longer say she. I no longer say she turned into a boy. I just say he. Okay. Boy. So Penelope boy.
So when he
revealed
was being changed, the diapers, was being put into dresses and having bows in the hair, and he is rejecting that because you don't know. Mm-hmm. And then you get to this moment. Tell me the whole, how that happened.
So I am a mother of five, and we're living in Manhattan, and we have this accelerated life with businesses and children and expectations to fulfill. And so just the backdrop is trying to get my kids fed to school, dressed,
homework,
yeah. Home, dinner, bath time, bedtime. Like for parents of multiple children, the goal is bedtime.
Right.
Right.
It's, routine.
It's bed. And so I'm really busy at this time. And everything is working in the way I think it should work, except for this one kid, Penelope, who's the third child. Penelope is so troubled. Everything is resisted. Brushing teeth, combing hair, getting dressed, diaper change. Even before there were physical words from Penelope, the body language was, everything was like pushing me away. Changing a diaper, anything to the body was traumatic. And so I had to actually have Dad come and help me change the diaper. Dad would hold baby Penelope down. I'd put the diaper on. We'd both be sweating. It felt weird because you don't want that kind of fight around the baby. So two years pass, and Penelope is having nightmares every night, reoccurring nightmares, nail biting, bedwetting, pushing brothers, pushing friends at the park, knocking over blocks. First word was no. Most of the time, Penelope did not want to be snuggled by me. You know, and I thought, I know how to take care of girls. I'm a good mom. But Penelope was rejecting. And so I did things like, Penelope asked for a haircut. Reluctantly, eventually we gave Penelope a haircut, short haircut. Penelope wanted jeans. Reluctantly, eventually we gave Penelope jeans. Those things eased Penelope a little bit, but they didn't change the scenario completely. They weren't enough. And so one day in the summer, Penelope had just been a terror all day, knocking over brother blocks. So I scoop Penelope up and give us both a timeout in the bedroom, and we sit on the floor. And it was really the first time I had taken timeout with Penelope, like a literal timeout and then just a mental pause.
It's interesting. You were not punitive. You are on timeout, but we are going to go together to talk.
Yeah. And that was rare because usually I'm like, you know, changing the diet, changing the bedtime, fixing the outfits, color coordinating. Maybe Penelope is grabbing brother's clothing because Penelope is confused. So I was like organizing the house more. And so this time I just picked up Penelope. We sat on the floor and I asked the question, why are you so angry all the time? Tell me why. And then Penelope like opened up. You could see the open, and then the tears started flowing. And Penelope said, well, because everyone thinks I'm a girl, and I'm not. So I...
He's crying.
He's crying. I mean, really just...
Did he say it or scream it?
No, not screaming. He was... We're sitting on the floor. It's quiet, and he's just telling me, really, like, exhausted telling me, like, thank you for asking me. I've been waiting for someone to ask. Mama, I love you. I don't want to be you. I want to be Papa. I don't want tomorrow to come. Tomorrow I'll look like you. I want a doctor to make me a peanut. These are things that Penelope is saying about Penelope's life that I had no clue of.
At three.
My kids are very verbal. And I'll also put a footnote in that, which I've learned later on, around three is when the brain starts to identify. So the brain places every one of us at around three in context to the world. My kids just happen to be in a house where you can speak up and talk and say anything you want, for better or for worse. And so Penel said, everyone thinks I'm a girl and I'm not. So I thought, okay, here's a girl who wants to be like her brothers. Here's a girl who wants to be seen as tough, not weak. Here's a girl who's noticing sexism, right? 3 years old, but like you're maybe a budding feminist, maybe a budding lesbian. Like I just trying to think of what I knew to grab onto. So I said, however you feel is fine. If you want to act like your brothers, you go ahead and act like them. And then, yeah, Penelope knew I wasn't getting it. And that made him mad, actually, because I was denying him still of something. And he said, Mama, no, I don't feel like a boy. I am a boy. And then I just stopped talking.
What did you feel?
Shame. I thought I had dropped the ball on raising a smart, confident girl. Like, I thought I had dropped the ball on feminism. I thought in all this busy city Soho living, I forgot to read the books and tell the stories about Nina Simone, Billie Jean King, Toni Morrison, Maya Angelou, you know, all of the sheroes. And I thought, I forgot to instill pride in this girl. She's reading into sexism and doesn't want any part of weakness. So she's opting out, I thought. So I was feeling guilty and unaccomplished, like all the things that you think you're getting ahead of, you know, buying a house and starting a business. And then your kid tells you, you got it all wrong. Sort of smacked me down to size. So I actually stopped talking and I just listened for probably an hour.
What did he say after that?
Talked about the body a lot. He said, I don't want this body. I don't want it. I remember he said, there are a few things that I remember very clearly. Mama, I love you. I don't want to be you. I want to be Papa. And I remember saying that I would help, that there are doctors that can help. But I didn't really, and then people have said to me, what did you mean by that? What were you really prepared to do? I don't know. I have no clue. I was just, because, you know, when your kid is there speaking so, coming in peace, first of all, he wasn't screaming. I thought maybe he would say, I hate this family. You're so stupid. But he said, I am a boy. And he said it in peace. And so when someone comes to you in peace, you have to receive that. So I wasn't concerned with saying no to him. No, you're wrong. Or no, that can't be. I was more concerned with saying yes. And I'll help. Because he was confiding in me and relying on me. So we just, we sat there. And then when we came out of the room, I sort of downplayed it, right, to Dad. Because we knew Penelope had been different.
Difficult
and different and tomboyish, right? So I just said, oh, Penelope wants to be a boy. And he said, yeah, we know that. And then I said, I got that. You just, you know. You handle the other kids. Because that's what you do when you have multiple kids sometimes, you know. You right. juggle. So I left. I kept that.
So you weren't, at that moment, you weren't fully.
Oh, I was fully in.
You got it. My child is trans.
I don't think the word trans was so alive in my mouth. But it was more that I knew there was something bigger than I thought. I knew that it was not about presentation. It was more about identity. And I knew, I had images flashing through my head. Like I had Silence of the Lambs, the psychopath wiggling and tucking his penis between his legs. Mm-hmm. I had Paris is Burning, mm-hmm. Flash, that documentary about the kids in the West Village. Mm-hmm. Many of them died. Mm-hmm. So I had a slight understanding of gender nonconforming, but it was muddled with all these really sad stories. Yeah. So I left the room with he in my head. Penelope was no longer she in my head. And I also left the room with a feeling of save Penelope. That was really the directive, save Penelope. And it consumed almost all of my time for the next several years.
Well, first, you had to get equipped to dealing with the situation. And you say in the book, you were ill-equipped at that mm-hmm. moment, even though you were emotionally accepting, you know, all you had was images of like
death and destruction,
yeah, tragic trans stories. How did you get equipped?
I went on the internet, actually. I was probably reading Malcolm Gladwell at the time, and he says 10,000 hours to becoming an expert. Mm-hmm. And so I just dove into the internet. And so at night, you know, with my laptop close to me so no one really could see, Joe didn't really know what I was doing. I was plugging away and typing in words and coming up with finding doctors and hospitals and theories and organizations and peer groups that were helpful in some ways, sort of. At least it was, they were showing me that there was a lot out there I didn't know. So I learned a new language, you know, transgender, cisgender, polyamorous. Some people go by they, them, there. Mm-hmm. Didn't even think about that, right, as identity. Mm-hmm. So there's a language that I took in over the months. And then there were organizations that I reached out to. And then there were doctors and theories that I absorbed. That's where it got tricky, because the theories are, at the time in particular, you know, that this was, something had gone wrong. No one quite knew what was wrong. Maybe a surge in hormones in the mother's body during pregnancy, but something was off skew. And then there's also conversion therapy, where doctors, you know, try to correct the child through really torturous practices. So I got a lot of information, I kind of got nauseous from a lot of the information.
Yeah.
But I did find folks, people, families. There's one family, there's a young girl named Jazz Jennings, and she was one of the youngest out trans public figures. And there were all these documentary stories on her and her family. And her family was so supportive and proud. And they used the word transgender. And Jazz, the child, said, "My body is male, my brain is female. Period. That was it." And I thought, oh, there we go. That's a very clear way of describing it. No other explanation needed. The body and the brain aren't always in the alignment that we think they should be in. I now see them quite aligned with Penelope. I don't see Penelope as off center or...
I mean, you saw massive changes in this child once you were able to be accepting of his reality.
So it took a while for me to even understand what acceptance or support looked like. And it, in my family and in many families, it's language. I changed my language around Penelope. I said he, him, his, son, grandson, nephew, cousin, boy cousin. So I changed my language. I also allowed Penelope just to go and find the clothing that you like to wear. For a long time, I was like trying to bring girl tomboy clothing, you know, present tomboyish but cute, sassy outfits for Penelope. So really, Penelope chooses his own clothing, decides his own haircuts, picks his own friends. I left him to his own will and desire. And almost everything that Penelope liked when he was young are the same things he likes now. He didn't like change, you know, into this other boy. It was really the language and the clothing that changed the most.
Mm.
Penelope is great at math. So he's 11 now. He's an A student. He's great at math. He was class president. He's competes in karate against boys and girls, now specifically boys, because he's at that age and he wins. But he's also really creative. He writes short stories. He's also really vain. I can't get him out the mirror. You know what I mean? Like, so I never said, okay, if you're a boy, you have to be this way. He just does what he likes, and he does what he does, and he does it well. And I say he, him, his.
There are all these little ways that we as parents tell our children, you know, this is what's expected of boys. Yeah. This is what is. And I'm sure you were doing that before.
All the time.
And did it become, with all five of the kids, did you become sort of hyper aware and change your approach to your other children?
Completely. So I had, you know, and especially with a house full of five kids, I had girls' clothing on pink hangers, boys' clothing on blue hangers, princess toothbrushes versus superhero toothbrushes, butterflies on girl diapers, trucks, and superheroes on boy diapers. Everything was gendered. I even spoke to the girls, kind of like, come on, girl, yep. let's have some good girl time.
Yep.
And then with the boy that was, Cassius, Othello, even I think to their father, Joe, you know, we need to. And so I think what I notice now is the dynamics between people. I thought at one time boys were to be wrangled and gotten into shape. Otherwise, they would outpower me. Mm-hmm. And girls, I kind of just, you know, wanted them to explore the world because they needed that as girls. You know? They needed the approval.
Yeah.
And so I changed all of that. I started just talking nicely as best I could to all my kids, you know. I was like, maybe everyone needs, you know, nice tonation. But on a larger note, what ended up happening, once I said, Penelope, you know what, whoever you are is for you to say, all the other kids started raising their hand. Well, Mama, if you're listening to Penelope and Penelope's differences, you might want to hear mine. And I have a whole list of them. And so each kid came out with something that was really important.
I mean, I imagine, yeah, this would be an explosion within
totally.
The group of you. So it's not just for you and Penel to work through, but you got to go to the other children and say.
In a sense. I mean, I didn't ask anyone. You know, once I saw that the it was like life or death. You know, I could either be with Penelope, protect Penelope, or be against him. And I knew that outcome. There's statistics around, you know, trans youth, over 50% of trans teens attempt suicide. So it was really for me life or death. Am I with my son and am I going to help him live?
And that was a specific, I mean, right. I mean, he was specifically mentioning not wanting to
absolutely
be around.
And then add on that he's black. Mm. Black trans, you know, is a super wicked problem.
I mean, he's
in America.
He specifically said to you that he wanted to.
I don't want tomorrow to come. So that's a sign of suicidal tendencies. And if left alone, they would have grown. Could have grown. And so really I wasn't, it was just, I was on Penelope's side and whatever that took, because it distilled down to life. I don't care what jeans he wears. Honestly, I don't even care the language. As long as everything that he is reading, touching, seeing supports him, that was my only objective. And so I wasn't asking permission from anyone. However, it did lead to a complicated home life because people are individuals and not everyone is on the same page at the same moment. So one brother, his older brother, Cassius, is a scientist. He's 13, but he's a scientist. And everything in life has to go through this lens of science for him. So he needs proof. And he asked for proof for everything. You know, prove to me that trans exists. Until you do, I won't believe it. And he said, look, I will support my brother, respect him. I'll even use the right pronouns that he wants. But if we're talking scientifically, Penelope is physiologically girl. He's a 13-year-old. So, you know, I mean, there is science to go against what he's saying. There is science to prove gender variance. We know this. But 13-year-old kid says, it's not proven. I need science. And so then Penelope, you know, says back to him, look, it's not just science-y all the time. You know, this is who I am. God made me this way. I'm here. I exist. Therefore, trans is proven. End of story. And, you know, Cassius's answer to that, well, God's not proven. Trans is not proven. Hit me with some facts, kid.
I mean, you got other little kids. You got Othello there, yeah. Who's a little, Othello is younger.
He's younger, and so he doesn't know Penelope any different than this. It's so normalized for Othello. Honestly, he doesn't wrap his brain around it. He doesn't stutter over pronouns. He even asked me one day, so when Penelope grows up, he'll have a body like daddy, right? And I said, no, he won't. But he goes, but when he gets bigger, he'll have a big hairy penis like daddy, right? And I said, no, he won't. Penelope's a trans boy. His body is different. Othello did not understand that this boy, his brother, wasn't like any boy or wasn't going to be like any man, you know? So I had to unpack that a little bit for him. But really, when Othello has only grown up with his brother Penelope.
You are at age 11.
Yeah.
You're right on the lip of puberty.
That is true. That is true.
What do you foresee? What are you guys going to do?
Well, so the doing, you know, here's parents of trans kids, we fast forward to puberty starting at age 3.
Right.
Like the first thing I thought about was, what's Penelope's body going to do? Who's going to hurt Penelope when his body reveals that he's a, you know, that feminine in his presentation, in his body? What's going to happen in high school? What's going to happen on the first date? Who's going to hurt Penelope?
Yeah.
Your brain fast forward to puberty. So I've had to, in these years, pull back, like prepare, perhaps get some information, perhaps. So I know, like, I know the team at Mount Sinai Hospital. I know all the surgeons. I have a lot of my friends. I've asked questions about what is it like taking testosterone every day? What is it like for some trans? I have trans friends who chose not to change their bodies, right? So I've asked a lot of questions amongst my friends. I've aligned myself with hospitals and doctors. And then I'll let it sit right there because I don't know what Penelope's going to want. Perhaps Penelope wants to take testosterone. Perhaps he does not. Right, so the narrative that I thought existed, you're trans, you understand it, the people around you understand it, then you go on T. Then you have, you know, for a trans boy, then you have top surgery. I don't know if that's the case. I don't know. Maybe that is not all the options. And so I want to make sure that I don't hyper-analyze Penelope's body. I want to make sure I'm aware of the changes in his personality as his body changes. I want to make sure I keep asking questions, asking Penelope, how are you feeling?
Yeah.
What are you thinking? What do you want to do? And I want to make sure that he's in an environment that is trans, queer, LGBT friendly. That's primarily because I think that will take away some of the urgency, perhaps, to make quick decisions. You know, I think community has been the biggest thing for us. Just go to places where you're understood and loved.
Sometimes you need stories that reflect the community, the culture, the world that you love. You can get some of that on NPR's new collection, Black Stories, Black Truths, where you'll hear stories of joy, resilience, empowerment, and how to create world-shifting things out of struggle. Every episode is an account of what it means to be Black today, told from a unique Black perspective and diving into the things that we care about and the stories we want to hear that center Black perspectives. In NPR's Black Stories, Black Truths, you find a collection of some of NPR's best podcast episodes that celebrate the Black experience. Turn on NPR and listen to Black Stories, Black Truths. Because Black stories make up what it means to be in America, and stories should never be told without us. Listen to Black Stories, Black Truths from NPR, wherever you get your podcasts. Great Expectations is a new novel from the New Yorker staff writer Vincent Cunningham, a keenly observed novel about a young Black man searching for his place in the world amidst a moment of historic change. Great Expectations is about the main character David's 18 months working for Senator Obama's 2008 presidential campaign. Along the way, David meets all sorts of people who raise questions about history, art, race, religion, and fatherhood that force David to look at his life in a new way and come to terms with his identity as a young Black man in America. Colin McCann says Great Expectations will be one of the most talked about novels of the year. And others have called this book epic, intimate, and brimming with brilliance. It got a starred review in Publishers Weekly, which is a big deal. And it's a coming of age story that takes you inside the Obama campaign like nothing else. Great Expectations is an extraordinary book, available wherever books are sold.
Influencer. It's a word that gets tossed around a lot these days. There is a woman who went the distance, who broke ground as the first true influencer by living a remarkable life. Her name, Elizabeth Taylor. I'm Katy Perry. This is the story of the original influencer. This is Elizabeth the First.
Elizabeth the First, the podcast. wherever you listen.
Talking about creating a community that is honest to who you and Pinnell want him to be, who he is, mm-hmm. You talk a lot in this book about coming out to the family. And it's a really powerful story about writing a letter together, which I never even realized would be a part of a trans person's life. But you work together to write this letter and send it out to the family. And some people are super
on it.
Yeah. And some people are not.
Yeah, the crickets, the silence. I wanted Penelope to be a part of his process to claim himself. And it's an exercise that we all need to do, right? Claim yourself, express yourself, let people know who you are, and then see who's down with you, right? And so we wrote this, I sketched out a letter, and then I showed it to Joe, dad, first. And then once we both agreed on it as parents, and we showed it to Penelope and asked Penelope to edit it and add his own, and approve of it. And the letter announced to family and close friends that Penelope is trans and that Penelope is a boy and that we are allowing him and insisting that he present in the most authentic way. And we were insisting that the family interact with him as a boy and acknowledge him as a boy. And so Penelope was so proud of it. And he sealed the envelopes and handed them to folks and put them in the mail as if he were, you know, inviting them to his high school or college graduation or wedding. You know, it was really something that he felt good about.
Big moment for him.
It was a huge moment for him. And for us too, because once you put that stuff when you put it in words and write it and then mail it, old school mail it, it felt really powerful. And then we use that. Anytime someone was confused, we would just hand them the letter. Principal, hand her the letter. You know, friend, hand the letter over. Karate teacher, hand the letter over. And then it gives people time to sit and digest. And then you come back a day or two later and make that the demand.
But there were crickets.
Many family members did not respond. They felt a certain way, I assume. And then when they did respond, it was, is this the right thing to do? Is this safe for Penelope? Are you really thinking about long term? It's like as if I hadn't been thinking. But the concerns were valid. You know, why are we putting a word on this child? Mm-hmm. An ugly word, transgender, this ugly word. Why are we putting this ugly word on her? Why are we insisting on something that might be just, you know, a phase? And why are we publicizing it? Why are we opening up the conversation to other people that might not want the best for Penelope? I think all that's bullshit. Personally, people just don't want to change. Penelope had already come out. He'd already stated he's not going back. Penelope had already given us who he was. It's up to us to change or not. But like the fact that Penelope is trans was not going to shift whether or not we said he or she.
Right.
He would just be a boy, a trans boy without his family.
Right. Right.
So who's, right. You know, that's a loss right there. So the idea of like, well, let's give, you know, let's back up, let's slow down, let's, all of that is for folks who are uncomfortable with change. None of that was about Penelope, in honesty, because he had been insisting 3, 4, 5 years now.
This right? is me.
I am a boy.
Unwavering.
Yeah, unwavering. Never back, even when his dad said, well, if you're a boy, you're going to have to tell me. Face to face. So Penelope's like 4 years old, little shrimpy kid. And dad said, if you are really a boy and if you want me to call you boy, then you have to tell me, to me, your father, that you're a boy. And Penelope's like, I'm a boy, dad. Never back down.
But that's interesting because the moment with Joe, he sort of approaches it in a sort of masculine way. Like, you want to be a boy?
Yeah.
So say you're a boy in a boyish way, and I'm going to stand up to you like a man, and like, what's up? And like, apparently he passed a test.
He handled it. I mean, he's always said, I am a boy, even in uncomfortable situations, even when everyone's kind of staring at him. He, you know, one Thanksgiving, you would see him in a dress because I was dressing him in dresses. And then the next, he was coming with a mohawk, with some high tops, with a jersey on, and probably, you know, throwing the first punch on the basketball court if someone didn't really, if someone disrespected him. He completely, by the, in 1 year.
From 3 to 4.
The physical presentation was so extreme that you really would have to deny this kid to not be on board.
But was the holiday get together fraught and complicated?
So as an adult, I noticed the tension. But, you know, I have to say, no family member walked away. No family member said, no, I will not, or this is horrible, or I can't love. There was never any love lost, but there was quietness, silence. I noticed that people never said he or trans. They just worked around in long form. Well, I'm coming to take Penelope to the park. Does Penelope want Penelope's sneakers, or does Penelope want Penelope's sandals? You know, and once Penelope's hungry, does Penelope like a sandwich, or does Penelope prefer? So I noticed that people were moving around gender in their own way, which, you know, I can take that. I can take that. Grandma stayed on both sides. Grandfather stayed. African grandfather from Ghana stayed in Penelope's life. Cousins, everyone did.
Your mom.
My southern mother.
Your mom got it.
It took her a long time. I had to keep saying, "Google it, mom." I don't have time. Google it. Come back with some more information, mama. Here's a link. Start there. Get back at me. I mean, a couple of times she gave Penelope. I remember this one birthday. Penelope got a tote bag with flowers and butterflies. I mean, it was the wrong gift. Penelope felt horrible and said, you know, please tell grandma it looks like love, but my style is more rock and roll. So can she please just give me something rock and roll next time?
And you wrote to your mom telling her that.
It pissed me off most of the time. I was angry for many years, not at my kids.
Right.
I was angry at the adults.
I've sensed sort of the mama bear mm-hmm. of like, my child needs something. The world is not catching up.
Yeah.
I will make you catch up.
Yeah.
Was it some of that?
It was that. And I don't know if that's the best approach. You end up putting a divide between you and other people, adults. So although I did protect Penelope, there weren't many places where he never walked into environments and felt beat down. You know, once or twice or three times, maybe we had some, you know, folks trying to out him. But generally speaking, I was able to get up in front of Penelope, move weird people out the way, you know, silence the naysayers, but really just give Penelope a space. But in doing that, I was always in confrontation with other adults. So that put a strain on my marriage, as you can imagine. It put a strain on my extended family. Yeah,
I mean, you are very open about it in the book. Your husband's family does not catch up. They are not ready.
I would say that they are not. You know, it's like, are you? It is a. So here's what I've learned, is that you don't toss people out. People surprise you all the time. So they have yet to say the word transgender. I don't even think they've read the book. I don't think they've watched the documentaries that have like 11 million views, right, on my family. But they are in Penelope's life every day. And so if I hadn't witnessed that, I would be really pissed off, you know, at those who didn't understand. If I didn't have this science kid in my own home, if I didn't have my son Cassius, who needs scientific proof, that I would be really angry at all of the people out there who are using bogus science to negate trans folk. But I have those people in my family, right? And if I didn't have Penelope, I probably wouldn't understand trans needs.
Of course.
So I've got, you know, what I'm seeing in my family is a microcosm of the world. And the goal for me now is not to agree, really. because Penelope and his brother Cassius have not gotten any closer to agreeing.
Yeah.
They're, you know, 5 years into this debate, still on opposite sides. But the goal to me is to debate and disagree with decorum and respect. And so, you know, so be it. They might not use the word trans, or they might not, but there's a level of respect in our family that surpasses it, I think.
It's such a great moment in the book when you guys go to the trans camp.
Yeah.
And you discover all these other families. And tell us about that, because I had no idea that that sort of thing even existed until before you told me about it.
Right. So one day, you know, with summertime comes and you have to figure out what to do with your kids. And it became really difficult because I don't just turn Penelope over to anyone. As a parent, you don't. But in particular, I'm very cautious around the environment in which I leave Penelope in. So camp, I would find myself crying, just dropping Penelope off at the YMCA, because I didn't feel that people could be trusted, and I didn't feel that they understood. And I would try to see in their eyes if they conveyed any sort of disgust. So I was oftentimes really scared and nervous. And so one day Joe goes, we should start a camp for trans kids. And I thought, oh, like one more thing on the list of things to do. So I ended up finding a camp that exists, that services hundreds of families. And each year, several times a year, as an entire family, you can go into the mountains to this camp, Camp Aranudik. And
in
a secret place.
Okay.
Because for safety, you know, so it's a campground. We own our own camp. We have mountains and we have lakes and we have rock climbing and all the great things that you would have at camp, cabins. And families come and they bring everyone. You can bring a grandmother, a sibling, a cousin, a lover, a boyfriend, a girl, anyone who cares for this family and this child. And you really don't, half the time, don't even know who's trans and who's not. So I brought my entire family. I said, okay, this year we're going to find friends who are trans. And I don't want to hear anything about it. We need more friends that are trans. So my kids thought it was awkward, right? Like, you can't just go find people. They're not lost, mama. And but it worked, because now we go twice a year to this camp. And some of my best friends have been made at the camp. And some of my children's best friends have been made at the camp. And it's so funny, because they'll say, you know, we've been going for 5 years now. And they don't know who's trans and who's not. They're like, wait a minute, so-and-so's trans. I'm like, yeah, you didn't get that? That was the memo.
Yeah. When you run up with your five kids, it's not clear.
Nobody knows.
Like, which, you have four boys, mm-hmm. right? Like, which is the one? Like,
they thought Georgia, my daughter, who's cisgender and she's 19, they thought Georgia was the trans person who was trans. And she thought that was such a compliment. It's funny. I mean, what you expose your kids to matters.
Yeah.
And so now I have exposed my kids to this, the truth, which is there is gender variance. There is so much more than the two options, male or female. And when you see that in real life, in real time, the confusion around it just kind of goes away.
I wonder how your current living situation makes you reflect back on the New York and the experiences that we've had. I mean, 20 plus years hanging out in New York, you know, clubs to becoming mm-hmm. parents. And there was a community of people who at that time might be called tranny, might mm-hmm. be called cross-dresser, might mm-hmm. be called, he's just doing his own thing. And some of them were doing it in a very, let's say, sexy level, and were appearing on talk shows and mm-hmm. were you know, maitre d's, or, you know, nightclub sort of people, nighttime people. And some were sort of struggling to get through and understand, how do I deal with this? And that precedes, I would say, what, the last 5 years, where there's been this rush of like, no, like, you must like understand. And mm-hmm.
And I do think it was growing up in New York, in high school and then post college, living downtown in the East Village and Soho and in Tribeca, and then moving to Fort Greene and being around creative people, you know, musicians and strippers. Writers and restaurateurs, architects and clothing designers. I mean, these friends of mine had ideas and then birthed ideas. They had perspectives and turned those perspectives into something that the world was able to see. And so you would think that I would be open to almost anything, being a native New Yorker, right? 40 plus years in New York. And I was, and I am, but what I didn't, so I had some flexibility, but I never knew that gender was flexible.
Mm.
So I knew that, you know, race and class and religion, and there were all kinds of preferences and all kinds of nuances, but I didn't understand that gender was also a part of that nuanced component of human existence. Just never questioned gender.
I never did either until this recent sort of...
Mm-hmm.
But I think I felt that women had more range, could be more fluid. And before I even heard the phrase, I felt that masculinity was a prison. And I felt like these are the ranges of behavior that are acceptable for a male. And if you go outside of that, then you're not really a man. And there were times when I was outside of that, and there were definitely people in my New York City extended community who were like, is he gay?
Yeah.
And I'm like, and that would be reflected back to me. And I'm like, no, I'm not. Now, there's anything wrong with that, but I'm not mm-hmm. performing in a traditional way.
Yeah.
So now I have to deal with
it. I have a friend who has become one of my closest friends. His name is Teek Milan.
I know Teek.
Yeah, he's great. He's smart. He's a lot younger than I am. And he has a way of laying it on the table, whatever we're talking about. It could be marriage, it could be gender, and just really looking at what is, not what we want it to be, but what is, what are we really dealing with, right? And so he's opened my eyes to a lot of things. And one of the things he said to me, he said, you know, the myth is that black men have two emotions, lust and anger.
Mm.
That's it, just lust and anger.
Yeah.
When I look at my children, as young people, those are the last two things I'm thinking about, right? Lust and anger. So you see all of this variation of emotion in my boys. And now raising a trans boy, I see all this variation in Penelope. And it has allowed me to encourage all of my boys and all of my girls to be as varied as possible.
Mm.
Because it is such a disease to think that we lie in two emotions. It just doesn't give us enough room. We yeah. underestimate our potential. I mean, it is a scenario that does not end well if we have lust and anger as our only two places to dwell.
And we're not even encouraged to be emotionally literate, mm-hmm. right? And to think about your emotions and to be aware of them. And I think women encourage each other to do that, and men don't yeah. talk about that at all.
Yeah.
And it leaves you emotionally illiterate.
And I tried to bring that out with my children. So I wanted to, one of the things that I liked, my mom, how my mom raised us, she raised us to be creative and to visualize. So she always had us visualize our dreams in a meditative form. So she taught us meditation in the 70s. And she would sit back in the backseat of the car with us, and wherever we were going, whether it was a gymnastics competition or a tennis competition or to a test at school, she would have us visualize the test, filling it out, answering the questions, writing it on the paper, turning the page. She would have us visualize the gymnastics routine to the point where your body was actually moving, although you were sitting in the backseat of the car.
Yeah.
Visualize it. And I brought that to my kids, and so... you know, story time at night, I would create these images where the main characters were similar to my children. So Rapunzel has long cornrows. The princes had dark skin and afros. They were set in Africa, in Ghana. Like, I wanted them to feel central as black people. I wanted the boys to feel capable.
We live in a world where you can get anything you need delivered to your door thanks to DoorDash. If you don't want to do the dishes or you feel a little sick, let DoorDash bring dinner tonight. My family uses DoorDash all the time because it connects us to our favorite restaurants without us having to drive. Last night, we got some Indian food for my wife, some gumbo for me, and sushi for the kids. And everyone was happy, and we didn't have to do the dishes. The process of ordering was quick and easy, and I love DoorDash for real. So I was so happy to do this for them because I'm a customer, because I know DoorDash is your door to more. Must be over 21 to order alcohol. Alcohol available only in select markets. DoorDash, your door to more. Download the DoorDash app now to get almost anything delivered. In my mind, the greatest author of the 20th century is Toni Morrison. And her greatest novel is Song of Solomon. A mesmerizing coming-of-age masterpiece that is gorgeously written and has captivated readers around the world. The protagonist, Milkman Dead, was born shortly after a neighborhood eccentric hurled himself off a roof in a vain attempt to fly. For the rest of his life, Milkman is trying to fly. As Morrison follows Milkman on a quest to uncover his roots and find the place of his family's origin, she introduces an entire cast of strivers and liars and assassins and the inhabitants of an amazing, beautiful, fully realized black world. The New Yorker said Morrison moves easily in and out of the lives and thoughts of her characters, luxuriating in the diversity of circumstances and personalities. Toni Morrison is a genius. She's one of the greatest writers of her time, of the century, and Song of Solomon is her greatest book, in my opinion. It's a must-read that will ignite your imagination and show you what the best possible fiction writing is like. And it's a timeless tale that will stay with you after you've turned its final page. When you get to the climax, you will feel it in your heart. Available now at tonimorrison.com or wherever books are sold.
As boys, I wanted the girls to feel capable as girls. And so I created stories that put them in the center of capability, possibility. And that was something that is something I still use continuously, like draft out, visualize your reality. And then it will follow, like form follows function. What you need to be, sketch it out and you will be it.
Some sea change has happened in the last, like, what, 4 or 5 years, that suddenly the trans community sort of got really loud and said, like, you know, we demand respect, and several sort of people were able to become national celebrities. And why did that happen?
Why does change happen?
When did that change? I mean, like, I understand why some of the gay rights movement happened.
Well,
but the trans awareness and rights movement, I don't understand why that happened when it did.
A lot of, trans and intersex and gender nonconforming is a mystery to many people. It is a different type of person to many people. It's an other. And as we notice throughout history, othering becomes bloody. So the trans community has come up, and you know, parents of trans kids have come up and said, enough is enough. There are, I think I want to say, 26 deaths, murders of trans, black trans women last year. And so when we look at the history of othering, I think people have just had enough. Parents have had enough. And the voice of each person can be seen and heard more through social media. Maybe that gives us a little bit of a momentum. You know, I think that I understand it to be different as a mother, and I just can't be quiet about it. So I think, you know, people get to the point where, like, enough death, enough living scared, enough not even knowing where my kid will go to high school, enough. So I'm thinking, Pinnell goes to high school in a year. I need to start talking to high schools. So I made it a point. I listed all the high schools and I said, can I come and speak to you? So, you know, why do people start to stand up? it becomes something you can't sit down anymore.
I mean, out of love, out of parenting, I mean, like, you're not an activist from an intellectual basis, from a parenting basis. Obviously, right. There's an intellectual framework, not to take anything away, but
Where will my kids go to school?
You start as a parent.
Where will we live?
Yeah.
Right. What will their summers look like if they can't go to a camp? So I started to go into spaces outside of my, because it started at my dining room table. Mm-hmm. I was an activist at my dining room table. And then when I started to think, where will my kids take a class, go to school? Where will they meet their friends? What parks? Then I started to go into those areas and ask and then demand for a different understanding. And, you know, if you ask why, I think it becomes a function of just life. You know, this idea that I started to see the correlation around, like, bathrooms and drinking fountains.
Mm-hmm.
So
mm-hmm.
Civil rights,
mm-hmm.
drinking fountains. Black folks can't use water fountains, right?
Mm-hmm.
Current day, trans people can't use public bathrooms. Well, if you can't hydrate and if you can't urinate, you probably will stay home. That's mm-hmm. called, you know, making someone invisible.
Mm-hmm.
We've been talking about it since Ralph Ellis. I mean, even before Ralph Ellis, the invisible man. And so America was trying to push Penelope and all the Penelopes and trans folk and gender nonconforming folk back away. Go. Don't come out. Don't be seen. And that, to me, is unacceptable.
It's easier now than it was 5 or 10 years ago, but it's still hard.
For whom?
For trans people and trans activists, mm-hmm. right? But it's still hard, right?
I can't say it's easier. I think that I have this privilege, obviously, as a cisgender person. I can talk about it. No one is threatening me directly. People will listen. I can go to NYU, Princeton, you know, Dillard, and speak about it with some authority, right, because I'm cis. And I do notice when I speak over the years, people have a different approach or a different response. They're a little more accepting or a little more open to hearing what I have to say. But I don't know if a black trans woman in South Carolina has it easier right now
right.
than 5 years from 5 years ago. I don't think so.
Right.
What is progress is that there are states that are pro-equality. There are some states that the legislature is pro-equality, and their elected officials are pro-equality. And so that perhaps gives a little bit of tiny bit of security, perhaps.
How has the book changed Pinnell?
Well, the my children haven't read the book yet, of course, because they're young kids. But the process that I went through to write the book affected them because I'm a better parent. So I had time to sit 3 years of writing the book and pulling up memories around gender. And pulling up examples around people in my family who are gender nonconforming, not just Penelope, but like histories of them, like long history of women in my past who did not follow status quo, men, black men who did not follow status quo in my lineage. And so when I looked at my history, I was able to put Penelope in context, and I was able to parent all of my children better. And so I think they're seeing a mom today that's just a better mom.
Yeah, just as a writer, how did you, just structurally, how did you have the time?
Oh, gosh.
And the energy to write a book as the mother of five and all the other things that are going on?
I had a really good team. So my agent, and I always say, get a good agent. My agent was the one to say, maybe think about who raised you. She literally asked me, who raised you, Jody? And that set me down the path of looking at my family, not just Penelope, the weird kid, but a legacy of people, right? So an agent was great. And then I actually worked with a woman, Maya Millett, who helped me structure my time, structure my thoughts, structure chapters. You know, I always thought that writing would be you sit at your desk by yourself in a quiet room and you write for months and then you deliver a beautiful manuscript. For me, I had to have a team, and Maya was this really essential component to the team. So she would record me.
Is she a friend? Is she a writing coach?
She's a writing, she's an editor.
Okay.
But my own, not with the publishers, right? So she recorded me. and then would transcribe, and I would work from my own words. Because sometimes when you're writing, the pressure is too much.
Yeah.
But when you're talking, when I was talking with Maya, I could let it all spill out. So she would record, transcribe, and I would work from that. Then I would write a chapter, and she would say, "This is great. You really get to the point of it on page 7. How about let's just start at page 7? So she had this bird's eye view, which comes with experience. And she could look at all my components and help me move them around so that the story was compelling. And also I had to remember, this is not a biography where you tell everything. It's right. It's a memoir where you look at certain memories that respond or relate to gender. And so Maya, I have to say, was fantastic with that. And then my editor, my team at Random House, they kept giving me more time. They said, go back, take more time.
3 years?
About 3 years, yeah.
Did you write mostly at night when they were asleep?
So a lot of the writing comes from journal entries that I had over the years. And then I have thousands of notes in my iPhone. I mean, literally was like pulling back from old writings. And then they would go to school every day. My kids go to school. So I have 5 solid hours every day to write. So I take them to school.
So you got it done when they were in school?
I wrote a lot during those critical hours when they were at school. And then, of course, when I was on deadline, of course, I would do, you know, later night writing sessions. But at almost 50, I can't pull all-nighters. It's just not going to happen. So I literally was using I said, if I write 5 hours every day, that's good stuff.
Yeah.
And then we would meet, Maya and I, my editor and I would meet once a week. And I had assignments. She put me on assignment, like, finish this chapter. by Wednesday, and we met, and we would look at it. So I was really I wasn't writing in a bubble, in a out of space. I was really grounded on deadlines.
Did you hire her? Is she a friend?
No, she's hired. So you can I hired her, and it was independent of my publisher. So Maya and I were responsible for delivering to my publisher, and that was great for me. I don't think I could have finished. I don't think I could have kept to deadlines. I don't think I could have. There were times when I was like, I can't write anymore. I don't have anything more to say. I don't have any more insight. I don't have anything smart. And she would just sit there and talk with me. And because sometimes you don't know what you have.
Right.
And so working with Maya was, she kind of developed the writer in me, I have to say. And so first chapter, I was like, Maya, I can't do this. Last chapter, I was like, don't edit anything. Don't touch it.
I got this.
This is as is. It's raw. Don't touch it. And I think my last chapter is one of my best chapters. So I really was like,
You grew, but you grew.
I grew.
You grew.
Yeah.
But it's a really...
I could not have done it on my own.
I mean, there's a lot of people out there who may not even be aware that they could hire a professional editor.
Absolutely. There's many ways to do it. You can hire a ghostwriter. You can hire a co-writer. You can hire an editor. You can hire someone to just sit there and bounce off ideas with you. So before I even found a agent... I bounced ideas off of 2 women, really good friend of mine named Jonica and another friend of hers who's a writer. And I said, I have this idea. And I spent a summer just writing and bouncing ideas and showing my ideas to these 2 women. And although that did not make it into the book, that helped formulate my ideas. And so I think this idea that the notion that we have to write on our own and deliver on our own, it didn't work. That's not how I did it.
The beginning is so powerful, and you're not just talking about having a trans child.
Not at all.
You're talking about being a woman.
I don't think Pennell comes into the book until like almost halfway into the book.
Yeah.
There was a period when I thought that I had dropped the ball on feminism,
right?
I wasn't able to raise a proud girl. And then there was a period where I sort of put feminism on hold. And then I had to go back and really look at my family, and in particular, the women. And so I started thinking about these women, but I was like, well, what did they have to do with my son, my trans son? And I couldn't get rid of them. They were in my mind. Pictures and stories of these women kept coming up. And I kept thinking, but this is contradictory to Penelope, because Penelope's a boy. and the women persisted. And so what I got from them is lineage. What I got from them was determination. If Black women could get up from nothing, if they could watch their children die, if they could watch families, if they could get up and continue on, change. My grandmother sued hospitals and schools and won in the segregated South and changed laws, right? Hearts and minds. So I just was using the women of my family as blueprint for how do we support, how do we get things done, how do we bring more life. And so now I think that feminism is how I'm raising both my boys and my girls, my trans and my cis, my everything. Feminism to me is the backbone of my family.
The beginning. Can I read the beginning, couple of paragraphs?
Please.
I've always been told that women are powerful, tenacious, and important, that we pull from limitless places, that we make magic wherever we go, shining light into the darkness, forming impenetrable shields with our love, that beneath moments of weakness are endless reserves of strength. But I, woman, am feeling none of those powers. A friend of mine once told me parenthood means delivering optimism to your children, but I'm filled with only pessimism about the future. It's clear to me that dark envelops light, bad beats up on good. Women do, in fact, break. Smiling requires an effort I just don't have. And joy, it's packed up its bags and gone elsewhere. Quote, I need to stay with you for a while, I heard myself saying to my mother over the phone, weary from the last few years. I just need to rest. I'm here, she said without pausing. Come as soon as you can. I bought a plane ticket to Atlanta the next day. I mean, that's just womanhood. That's not about, I have a trans son, and I'm the you know, the issue is not at all clear from that. It's just, here's a woman
broken
in crisis. She knows women have power. She cannot access it. She goes back to all the cradles, mom, the South. I need, you know, the bed. I need to rest. So powerful.
I played around with where to put that. That part was in the middle of the book and the end of the book and the beginning of the book. And it was, I decided to put it up front because, you know, going back down South was almost like the moment that I decided to heal. It was a bit of giving in, like we said earlier, a bit of finding something in you that is, that you have. Because I kept thinking, I'm not equipped. I don't know how to handle this. I don't know what's, I can't. In hindsight, I actually had all of that, all that I needed to deal with Penelope, but also to deal with any broke, anything broken. And so I want us to, as women and as providers, to think about how do we access our power? You know, how do we go back down South? Do we sit on the floor? Do we look at our lineage? Because there's a point in the book where I realized no one is going to save me. My strong dad's not going to come back from the dead and save me. You know, my ex-husbands, two of them, they're not going to come back and save me. And there's a, you have to access your power. And for me, it was in the stories of my women. That was the power.
It's amazing that now Padel is your happiest child and the one you worry about the least.
I hope that they're all happy. So he is pretty safe on solid ground right now. He feels confident. You can see it in all of the things he does. And, you know, I have to say this, it sounds like a very happy, neat story. I wasn't able to do for all the kids in the same way during those years. Those were critical years. And so now I'm backtracking on some of the time that I missed with the other kids. And I'm like, I'm here for you. You're a scientist? Okay, Neil deGrasse tickets. Like, what are we doing? We're going to go science all the way. And so I'm really building up my connections with the other kids.
That's beautiful.
Yeah.
Thank you so much.
Thanks, Teray.
Yay.
That was fun.
Thanks to Jody for a great interview, and thanks to you for listening. I'm on Twitter at Toray and on Instagram at Toray Show. Toray Show is produced by Chris Colbert of DCP Entertainment. Our photographer is Chuck Marcus, and we will be back next week with more knowledge from amazing folks
Because as we always say, the man can't shut us down.